Okay, so it's our pleasure to have here today Josh Foster. He's at the University of Michigan. And Josh, you can just share your slides whenever you want.
Yep.
And introduce your own title.
Can you all see it?
Yep.
And let's play. Okay, yeah. So thank you for inviting me to give the talk. My name is Josh Foster. I'm a fifth year PhD student at the University of Michigan. Well, normally I would say I'm a fifth year PhD student at the University of Michigan, but today we are on strike. So this labor is not representing the University of Michigan, but is instead for GEO 3550. In any case, the title of my talk is Astrophysical Searches for Axions. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about work I've done with my advisor, Ben Safdie, and also some of my collaborators on doing radio searches and X-ray searches for axions. So let's get into it. So first off, I wanted to give a little bit of a brief introduction to axions, although I'm sure they're very familiar to many of you in the audience. So what is an axion and why do we think it's important? So that story starts with the QCD Lagrangian. And it turns out there is a, I can't see my mouse. Let's see. Can you all see my mouse?
Yeah. Yes.
Wait, like where is it?
I cannot see it. Okay, well, we're just gonna proceed without me gesturing with my mouse, I guess. All right, so the point here is that in the QCD Lagrangian, there is a term that you could write down and you'd be totally justified in writing it down. It would look something like what's shown here. So you have this parameter theta bar, and it's multiplying the field strength tensor G, which is contracted into its antisymmetric tensor G dual. So this is a term you could write down, and it turns out to lead to CP violating effects. And there's no reason for it to not appear. There's nothing forbidding it. There's no first principles reason to have it go away. It could just be there. But it turns out in the theory that we write down for QCD, it's not. And that seems a little odd. So you could ask, why isn't it there? And maybe it is, we just haven't detected it yet. It turns out it's hard to detect in that it doesn't actually contribute to that many interesting physical observables. But one of them is the neutron electric dipole moment. So it's a hard calculation, but you can calculate roughly what you expect the neutron electric dipole moment to be as a function of theta bar. And it looks something like 10 to the minus 16 times theta bar in units of electron charge centimeters. You can go out and you can measure it. It might be hard, but you can. And we do our best to, and we find that we can put a constraint on the absolute magnitude of theta bar to be less than one part in 10 to the 10. That's a really funny coincidence because this theta bar is connected to a phase in the theory, and that phase can take on a value between 0 and 2 pi. And again, we don't have a selection mechanism, so you'd think it could take on some, you'd think in a probabilistic sense, it would be uniformly distributed on 0 to 2 pi, which should make a value that close to 0 sound very, very funny. It seems like a fine-tuning problem. And here, I guess, is a plot, and you can see we've been looking for the neutron electric dipole moment for something like 70 years now, although this plot is a little bit out of date. And we haven't seen anything, and we're in a region where we wouldn't have expected to see something, given the assumption that that theta bar GG dual term isn't actually in the standard model Lagrangian. Anyway, this seems very odd, and people wanted to solve this problem, which is known as the strong CP problem. And you do it in the following way. You introduce a new field, and we're going to call that field an axion. And that axion is going to appear in the QCD Lagrangian in much the same way that that theta bar term does. So I've modified my Lagrangian to look not like theta bar GG dual, but now theta bar plus A, the axion field, divided by FA, which is just an energy scale associated with the axion, multiplied by that GG dual. So now, excuse me, is there a question?
Oh, go ahead. It's just there's some...
I see. So the point here is now rather than just one constant theta bar in your theory, you have something that looks like an effective theta bar angle. And that's just theta bar plus A over FA. But really what that means is you've promoted this parameter to not be some fixed number, but something dynamical. So it turns out that the QCD vacuum is going to induce a potential for that axion field. Potential looks something like what I've shown you, at least at low energies. And you can see that that potential is minimized when the axion field takes on a value minus theta bar. So effectively, that means your effective theta bar, which is that theta bar and the axion field, now looks like it's zero. So this is known as the Pecci-Quinn mechanism, and it's a way that we dynamically eliminate the CP violation and alleviate the strong CP problem. So that's the first reason we think axions are interesting. But in this process by which axions start at their initial condition and relax down to their minimum, which sets the CP violation to vanish, it turns out what you have is some initial condition. Oh, my mouse is back. Cool. You have some initial condition of that axion field. And over the course of the universe's history, it begins to oscillate and decay down to the minimum. But there are some leftover oscillations. And those oscillations can produce, or they look like a relic abundance of axions today. And it turns out that you can pretty easily choose some axion parameters such that the axion is going to realize all of the observed dark matter abundance in the universe. So what that means is we could solve two problems at once with this axion, the strong CP problem, and what is dark matter. And that makes it a particularly compelling new physics candidate. I know this relaxation process isn't super trivial. It's something that my collaborators and I have worked on, but it's in principle a totally predictive mechanism. So on top of that, you might think that axions are a pretty natural extension of the standard model, just in that in string theory or grand unified theories, you might expect to get quite a few axions as just new degrees of freedom in, that you could go out and look for. Mm-hmm. Okay, so where do we actually look for them? Well, typically we think about looking for axions in terms of, and my mouse is gone, that's very frustrating. We look for axions and we think about them in terms of this parameter space, which is axion mass and their coupling to photons. The coupling to photons is something we sort of generically expect, especially for an axion that's coupled to QCD, as it can acquire a photon interaction through the U1 anomaly. But the point here is that this parameter space, you see a lot of white, which means we haven't probed it. And in particular, the best motivated regions are coming in, or at least in my opinion, some of the best motivated regions are coming in here. So this band is sort of the canonical QCD axion models where you can get, you solve the strong CP problem. And in addition, you have sort of this region up here where you don't necessarily expect the axion to be solving the strong CP problem, but you might have axions realized just as a degree of freedom, especially those plethora of axions realized in string theory or guts. And you should go out and look for those also. So the big problem we're looking at is that we have motivated regions of the parameter space that there are no probes for, or at least insufficient probes for. And we want to fix that situation. Okay, so how do we actually go and look for those axions? So one very obvious way of doing it is just to do some direct detection experiment. And the idea here is that you have a very precise laboratory setup, and you look for observable effects of an axion field in the lab. So there are experiments like ADMX, Haystack, MadMax. A personal favorite of mine is Abracadabra. It's an experiment I do some data analysis work for. There's also a very long-standing experiment called CAST and proposed follow-ups IAXO and URA. There are a few other experiments but just for the sake of brevity, I'm going to leave them out. And most of the experiments that are ongoing or proposed, not all, but most, are looking for the axion through its photon coupling. And in practice, what you're going to do is you're going to create a large magnetic field, and you're going to wait for an axion to come in, interact with that that external magnetic field, and produce a photon for you. And then you can look for the electromagnetic signatures. So I want to focus on the CAST experiment. So the CAST experiment is sort of an axion telescope. And what you do is you point your axion telescope at the sun, where you expect there to be some axion flux. And along the length of this telescope, you have a large magnetic field. So axions come into into CAST, they convert, they produce photons, and then you would record the photon. And what's important here for this experiment is actually that conversion probability. So that conversion probability is going to look something like GA gamma gamma squared. That's the axion interaction strength with photons, B squared, that's the magnetic field strength that you're providing for the axion to convert in, and L squared. So L squared, I'm going to give a little bit of a circuitous definition for, well, L I'm going to give a circuitous definition for as just the length over which the conversion process can occur. And there are different factors that are going to determine what your conversion length actually is. But for the CAST experiment, the conversion length is roughly the length of the experiment itself. Okay, so this is actually given some very nice constraints on axions that were shown in the previous plot. And what I want to tell you about is how you can basically do CAST in space. So the way we're going to do CAST in space is by looking at neutron stars. And the reason that neutron stars are a really compelling target is that, one, they're bigger than CAST, which is to say that if you were going to have conversion and the conversion was going to expect depend on some like volumetric factor, just by merit of neutron stars being really big, you'd expect a lot of conversion to be happening. But on top of that, you have really, really strong magnetic fields around neutron stars. So on Earth, you would say a strong magnetic field you could make in a lab would be something like 10 Tesla. And a neutron star is going to realize magnetic fields on the scale of 10 to the 10 Tesla. So if you're scaling like B squared, you're doing extremely well by looking at the large magnetic fields around neutron stars. Now, of course, there are downsides to looking in astrophysical environments. You know, the really obvious one is you're losing on 1 over distance squared. So you need those B squareds to make up a lot of the difference in that, you know, you're looking at neutron stars that are thousands of parsecs away, potentially. And you also have relatively messy astrophysical environments compared to, you know, what would I would consider a more pristine laboratory environment, which means that you sort of need to have a robust way of collecting the data and analyzing the data if you want to actually be able to set some limits or potentially make a discovery. Otherwise, you're just not going to be able to make heads or tails out of what you're doing. So that's what I'm really interested in studying. How do these axion signals appear in astrophysical environments like neutron stars? What do you need to do in terms of data collection? And how do you then analyze that data? So the first search I'm going to tell you about is a search I've been working on in radio frequencies. And it's actually a search for axion dark matter. So this is a search that's going to depend on axions being ambient in our galaxy in order to produce a potentially observable signal. So let's get into what a neutron star is really going to look like. So what we have is, you know, this large picture of a neutron star, and the neutron star is going to be rotating around some rotational axis, and it also has a magnetic dipole, and that magnetic dipole can be it doesn't have to be aligned with the rotation axis, although there are sort of neutron star evolution reasons to believe that it typically will be somewhat well aligned. In any case, you have a rotational axis and a magnetic dipole, and you're going to see these radiation jets around the neutron star, and that's not actually that important, but it's big and bright on this picture, so I wanted to make sure you weren't confused about it. What is important for us are these dipole magnetic field lines around the neutron star. And that's what's going to let us come up with an observable signal. So in this scenario, the neutron star is basically just sourcing a potential well. And there's all of this ambient dark matter, and it's falling in and escaping the potential well and basically just sloshing around. And on its own, that wouldn't be particularly interesting. But it turns out you can have a very efficient conversion process as these neutron stars travel, or rather, excuse me, as these axions travel through the neutron star magnetosphere. And the reason for it is around these, in these magnetospheres, you have ions and electrons. So you have some non-trivial charge carrier density. And that gives the photon a plasma mass. So normally this production of photons by conversion from axions is suppressed in part because of the momentum mismatch between a massive axion and a massless photon. But if the photon acquires a plasma mass and you match the masses, you can have resonant conversion. And much like we had in CAST, you're going to have a conversion that's going to look like G squared, B squared, L squared, where G squared is still the axion-photon interaction. B squared is now the magnetic field strength of the neutron star. And L squared is going to be the length over which the mass matching condition is sufficiently well met. It turns out this is about 100 meters. But it varies from neutron star to neutron star, and you need to know something about the neutron star properties to make an actual calculation of where this conversion radius is and what the actual extent of the conversion length is. Okay, but in principle, we can do that. So what we want to have is we have infalling axions. They pass through the resonant conversion radius, and that produces outgoing radio photons. That the radio photons is just basically a condition of conservation of energy, which says that the energy that the axions had outside of the neutron star potential is going to be the energy that the photons have once they make their way to Earth. So you're going to get radio signals, at least in the mass ranges that we're looking at.
I have a question, sorry. So is there any dependence on the density of electrons in that area or no?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so in this plot, I have, what I'm showing you is this mass matching condition for a particular model of neutron stars called the Goldreich-Julian model.
Okay, so I see, okay.
Yeah, and I have a little more to say about the magnetosphere modeling. But you certainly do have some dependence, or a large amount of dependence, rather, on the charge carrier density around these neutron stars.
And so then you're, okay, right. So then for your Goldreich-Julian current, then you're assuming, I guess, like a dipolar field of some magnitude.
I'll get to it. Basically, what you need to know about the neutron star is you need to know its field, the dipole magnetic field strength, and you also need to know the period. And if you know those two things, you can figure out the charge carrier density from the Goldreich-Julian model, and then you can figure out where your conversion radius is. So if we want to make a prediction for the radio signal, we need to know a few different things. We need to know the axion particle properties, so just its photon coupling and its mass. You need to know something about the astrophysical distribution of axions. So this is to say that if your neutron star is at a place where there are more axions, you're going to get a brighter signal. You also need to know something about the way that axions are traveling in the galaxy. And the reason is you have this story where axions are falling into the neutron star potential well. And how many of them are going to fall into the potential well is going to depend on how fast they're moving in the first place. Basically, gravitational capture. You do care about where this neutron star is, since you're going to lose on 1/d². And like I was saying before, you need to know the magnetic field and the neutron star period. So what you can see here is the radio flux that you expect for some particular converting neutron star. And the ways that you're going to win are by going to neutron stars with large magnetic fields and large periods that are at locations where axion density over distance squared is big. So that tells you the actual amount of radio flux. But the other thing that you're going to need to know is how does that signal actually show up? And this comes out of a conservation of energy argument, like I was making before, which is just to say that the axion has approximately an energy of its mass. So the photons, as they travel to Earth, are going to have an energy that looks like the axion mass. So they'll show up at a frequency that looks like axion mass over 2π when you look in radio. So there are some corrections. So that would have told you that you have a purely monochromatic peak in radio that would come from this conversion signal. You're going to get some corrections, and the two sources of corrections we think about the most are, one, you have some broadening by the just astrophysical velocity distribution axions. So that would broaden this monochromatic line to a width of 1 part in 10^6. You have additional effects that are going to come out of traveling through this neutron star magnetosphere, which effectively looks like a medium with some varying index of refraction, and that medium is then moving with respect to the axions and the photons. So it turns out to basically be a classical E&M problem just barely beyond the scope of Jackson in order to predict what the frequency width of this thing should be. But that's an exercise we go through, and we find that the frequency width should be about 5 parts in 10^6 instead of 1 part in 10^6 after you account for those medium effects. So what would it look like if you could look at all billion of the neutron stars in the Milky Way? It would look something like this. So I picked some fiducial axion mass, and I've created signals at each neutron star. So all of these little spikes are just the individual neutron star conversion signal. They have this one, this roughly 1 × 10^6 width. And what you're looking at is you're looking at all of the neutron stars in the Milky Way. Those neutron stars themselves have a velocity dispersion, and that's going to cause a Doppler shift of these radio lines. So there's sort of an entire Doppler shifted population envelope of relative width 1 × 10^3. So this is sort of going to give you two observational strategies. This is going to give you two observational strategies in that what you could do is you could look for the spike coming from individual neutron stars, or you could look for a somewhat broader spike coming from the entire population. But what we really want to do is we want to look for the spikes from individual neutron stars. And the reason is it turns out in radio detection, the significance at which you can make a detection for a line looks like the bandwidth of the line to the -1/2, which just means that we can detect narrower lines better than broad lines. And that means that we're going to get a better discovery reach and better limit setting power by looking for these narrow lines rather than the broad ones. But the broad ones do give a nice complementary search strategy. And it's one that we actually do look into some. I can talk a little bit more about that if anybody's interested.
So is the emission coherent or is it incoherent? I was curious.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by that?
Right. You know, so you have these, you have these radio waves being produced, right. You know, is the observable just the intensity or, can you look for any coherence? I mean, right. Because like the dark matter field itself, I guess will be somewhat coherent on some like de Broglie wavelengths, I guess, right?
Yeah. So I guess that it depends on the frequency resolution that you're looking at, right? Mm-hmm. So if I think that's maybe the way to answer this. So if I'm looking at a frequency resolution where I, it also has to do with the collection time. If I collect data for longer than the coherent time of the axion field, which is the scenario that we're going to be in because the data collections that we're doing are hours long, then you don't expect the axion to look coherent. Then there's a separate question of sort of how you do the data analysis of like, is that, so you would have some monochromatic line if you had arbitrarily good frequency resolution, and maybe you could have even resolved that line if you didn't do any sort of like downbinning of the frequency data that you were collecting. But you could certainly be in a scenario where even though where your signal would just appear in one frequency channel. Mm-hmm. Does that answer?
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Cool.
Actually, related to that, if I kind of follow an axion out and it's going through these various magnetic fields, is the picture that there's kind of a region of a coherent region of magnetic field that it's interacting with, or is it kind of going through many cells of randomly aligned magnetic fields?
Yeah, so for this Goldberg-Julian model, right, it's I'm just looking at a classical dipole field. So I guess I would probably call that coherent. It's reasonable to believe that you might have a turbulent, incoherent component of the magnetic field around neutron stars. And that's not something that we've included in our analysis, basically because there aren't particularly good 3D models of that yet. But there is a picture where you would be interested in studying the incoherent component of the magnetic field and conversion there.
Well, a rule of thumb is often if you take the coherence time as you move through these different regions of magnetic field and you compare it to the distance an axion travels before it converts to a photon, are they comparable or are they very different? Or
I'm sorry, could you? I didn't parse all the details there.
Well, if you're trying to get a handle on whether or not having incoherent magnetic fields would change the coherence of the photons you're getting, a rule of thumb for that would be that you get the biggest effect if the oscillation length is similar to the fluctuation size.
Right. So I think right now it's hard to say because you only have conversion over this like order 100 meter length. Where the math matching is achieved. So I guess what you're asking is how important is the incoherent part of the the turbulent part of the magnetic field in that 100 meter window.
Yes.
And my understanding is that the existing models of turbulence around neutron stars in their magnetic fields would lead you to think that contribution is subdominant. But again, the existing models for these turbulent magnetic fields aren't like super great.
Okay, thanks.
So I think that's certainly a question that you'd want to investigate in greater length. But I think the answer there is really on the neutron star modeling side rather than the, I could tell you it could matter in certain cases, right? I just don't know if that case is necessarily the one that is realized. And I have a weak reason to believe it isn't the case that's realized.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Okay. So those last examples, I was showing you sort of this forest of lines that you would have expected coming from the entire Milky Way population of neutron stars. That's not really realistic. That's not how we do radio astronomy. When we do radio astronomy, we point at a location on the sky, and then there's some beam, and that beam is sort of the angular area on the sky where we would be sensitive to a radio signal. So you have sort of two viable strategies if you're going to look for the brightest, an isolated neutron star line. And the things you could do is you could point your telescope at the galactic center. And the galactic center is a really good place to look. And the reason is the dark matter density is high and there's a large population of neutron stars. The other thing that you could do is you could just look for isolated neutron stars. So there's some isolated neutron stars we know about, and those would provide some pretty clean environments compared to the galactic center. So you'd think both of these could give you interesting limits, and indeed we find they do. I'll just get there. So first, the population observations at this galactic center. You do have sort of an interesting statistical problem, and the problem there is that most of the neutron stars of the galaxy haven't actually been discovered, right? We expect there's about a billion of them from population synthesis models and so on, but we certainly don't know about a billion neutron stars, much less the ones in the inner galaxy where it can be hard to look. So we need to make some population modeling assumptions to figure out what we expect the signal to be when we look at the galactic center. So that is going to most sensitively depend on assumptions about how the neutron star evolves from its birth to the present day, but it'll also depend on assumptions about the dark matter density in the galaxy and the stellar distribution. So the point here is that you can make some modeling assumptions, and even then, the signal that you have isn't a deterministic signal. It's one that you've just characterized statistically, and you need to accommodate the statistics of the expected signal in your analysis. So the major point here is when it comes to modeling neutron stars, there's sort of two ways we think that neutron stars might evolve. And in one of them, in the scenario that you would like for looking for axions at neutron stars, is you have a magnetic field that's frozen in at the time of the neutron star birth. So in that scenario, right, you have a neutron star that gets born a billion years ago, since why not? And maybe it has a really large magnetic field, like 10 to 15 Gauss, and then it just stays there. On the other hand, these magnetic fields might decay. So here I'm plotting, a pretty aggressive model for the magnetic field decay. And unfortunately, both the frozen-in magnetic field and the decaying magnetic field models are equally compatible with the neutron star data that we have right now. So what we're going to do for setting our fiducial limits is we're just going to assume this pessimistic scenario where the magnetic fields decay. And if it turns out with later observations of neutron stars done by astronomers who are interested in this sort of thing, and they find out that the magnetic fields are frozen in, then great, we're going to pick up a lot of sensitivity. But for now, we're just going to be conservative. The other modeling assumption you have to make is this dark matter density profile. Is it NFW or is it cored? And what we're going to do is we're going to benchmark limits in both scenarios. So I'm taking a scenario where the dark matter is NFW all the way down to the galactic center, and a scenario where the dark matter density is NFW until it's cored at a radius of about 600 kiloparsecs. And here what I've done is I've generated sort of example spectra that you would expect if you're looking for the brightest neutron star in conversion in radio, and you center on that point, and you look at the sidebands. So this scenario where we have the model one, the optimistic scenario for neutron star evolution, and an NFW dark matter profile is great. The signal that we're getting is something like 1,000 Jansky on our telescope. And one thing you do have to be careful about is you're looking at for the brightest neutron star, but other neutron stars can show up in your sidebands. So this scenario is great in that the sidebands tend to be about two orders of magnitude smaller than the brightest signal. And then I'm showing some variations where you can see in the most pessimistic scenario, which is model two, the pessimistic neutron star model, and then a core dark matter density profile, your expected signal is about six orders of magnitude weaker. So this doesn't actually change the way that you look for the signal. You're still looking for a spike. It just means that you need to interpret your data different for the different scenarios, and that's something that we'll do. On the other hand, instead of looking for these populations at the galactic center, what you could do is you could look for isolated neutron stars whose properties we know well. And it turns out there are seven of them. They are called the Magnificent Seven, I guess. So this was a 1960s movie that then got remade in 2016. It's a cowboy movie, I guess. I haven't watched it. But these neutron stars are pretty great in that they're radio quiet, so you wouldn't expect lots of backgrounds. There's no mechanism by which we expect them to be producing non-thermal emission that could bias us. And they're pretty close, at least on galactic scales, 100 to 1,000 parsecs. On top of that, they have pretty strong magnetic fields, something like 10 to the 13 to 10 to the 14 Gauss. And they all have periods that are around 1 to 10 seconds. They all give you pretty appreciable conversion signals. It's sort of just a matter of which ones that you actually want to look at. They all do have a pretty significant limitation, though, in that when you do this calculation, you need to figure out what the conversion radius is. And the conversion radius is going to depend on the magnetic field and the neutron star period. And it turns out that for axion masses that correspond to a signal larger than about 7 gigahertz, the conversion radius is actually inside the neutron star, which is to say you're not actually going to have conversion happen. So all of these are going to turn off at sort of intermediate masses. And you're going to have to look at the populations if you want to reach higher masses that the radio searchers are in principle sensitive to. OK, so how do we actually do these observations? So we took data with the Green Bank and Effelsberg radio telescopes. These are 100 meter telescopes in West Virginia and Germany. And basically what you do, you point on at a region on the sky that you think is interesting, then you point off so that you can try to get some statistical understanding of your backgrounds. And you do something called position switching where every 5 minutes you go back and forth between the two. And you also observe a known calibration source. So for us, the known calibration source was a quasar called 3C48. And it has just a very well characterized flux density spectrum that we can use to bootstrap up our measurements of less studied sources. We're collecting the data in two polarizations and a really high frequency resolution, which is going to enable us to look for these very narrow spikes. One of the things that's cool is actually that, like, you really are looking at real astrophysical systems. So we have an analysis procedure, and the first thing we do to make sure that our analysis procedure is working is to make sure that we can discover hydroxyl masers that are expected to appear in the data that we collected. And we indeed see them at enormous significance. And it's just neat that it's like real physics that shows up. But of course, when you collect data, it's never as clean as you'd like it to be. So we did a naive analysis, and the results are we were not proud of. And the main reason for that is in radio telescopes, and especially at the frequencies that we observed for in these observations, there's a lot of radio frequency interference. So what I'm showing you in this plot is the time evolution over the course of our collection of two directly adjacent frequency channels. And that's in black and blue. And you can see that there are features in one channel that don't appear in the other, and vice versa. And that's kind of very surprising. I mean, because the frequency resolution is one part in 10 to the 6. So whatever's causing this has a very high quality factor. Anyway, we implement a data cleaning procedure that allows us to remove these radio frequency interference times from our data collection. We then analyze the data just with a pretty straightforward Gaussian profiled likelihood, where what we do is we estimate the variance of the data outside of the frequency channel where we expect the signal to appear. And we take a very phenomenologically motivated background model, which is just a quadratic, and we do fits. And we set frequentist limits using that exact likelihood procedure. This is sort of what that might give you. In terms of, we're looking for a central spike. We don't see one at a high significance, and we set a 95% upper limit. So that 95% upper limit is actually on the flux density. It's not directly on the axion coupling. And I can compare what those flux density sensitivities to the theoretically expected ones that just come out of the radiometer equation. So it turns out the data that we collected with the Effelsberg telescope at the galactic center, that data looks great. So the real data is shown at in black. And the theoretical expectation for the sensitivity is shown in gray. So of course, there are some large-scale features that are coming in from large-scale interference, but they're much broader than the axion signal that we're expecting, which is why that we don't actually say we have a detection. On the other hand, the data that we collected with the Green Bank telescope had a much worse performance. So we had data at two isolated neutron stars, and the realized sensitivity is in dark blue and dark red, and that can be compared to the expected sensitivity, which is about an order of magnitude stronger. We haven't figured out why that sensitivity was so much worse, but we expect that it is related to just the sort of interference that you have plaguing radio observations in these this 1 to 2 gigahertz sort of range. It's something to be better understood, certainly. Anyway, another important test of this analysis framework is to say, if there is a signal in the data, can we recover the data? I think that's especially pertinent after that nanograv result, which basically came about from that they previously had a detection framework that couldn't ever detect a gravitational wave background. So what we do is we just inject flux excesses into the data, and we make sure that our 95% upper limit is always stronger than the injected flux excess. We also see that the Gaussian test statistic that we get out of the analysis is increasing, which means eventually it can exceed our detection threshold if something's actually there. So we have reasons to think that our likelihood framework is working effectively. So we go on, we set limits, and the limits look something like this. So in the shades of red, you have the isolated limits on the axion coupling from the isolated neutron stars that we looked at with the Green Bank telescope. So these are at something like 10 to the minus 11 inverse GeV. But you'll notice there aren't bands around them. And the reason that there aren't bands around them is that we don't have lots and lots of systematic uncertainties on those limits, because those neutron stars are so close that we've measured their properties well, and we also have a good understanding of what the dark matter density should look like there. In black, what we have is the limits that come from the Effelsberg telescope from looking at the galactic center. So the fiducial limits that we've set are in black. Those are similar strengths, about 10 to the minus 11 inverse GeV. But I'm showing these green bands, and these bands are supposed to depict the systematic uncertainties on what those limits actually are. So the black lines come from taking the pessimistic neutron star model, but an NFW profile. And if you make the profile chord, you get the top line. And if you take the optimistic model with the NFW profile, you get the bottom line. So right now, these are just systematic uncertainties around our results that we're trying to fairly depict with these bands.
Joshua, so you mentioned for the red curves, there's not much systematic uncertainty to translate from the, you know, from the radio measurements to this bound on parameters.
Yep.
So why again is that? Sorry, I didn't catch it, I think.
Oh, so okay. One of the big uncertainties is what the actual dark matter density is. But these isolated neutron stars are about 100 parsecs away, and we know the local dark matter density appreciably well, so we don't have that uncertainty. The other big source of uncertainty is that we have to do population modeling when we look at the galactic center. So you have to make this choice about, do you think that the magnetic fields decayed, or did you do you think they were frozen in? And then you do some modeling to get the expected signal.
For each neutron star, don't you also have, you know, for each one, don't you have some large astrophysical uncertainty and things like the amount of like electrons around, stuff like that?
Good. For the isolated neutron stars that we're looking at, you have magnetic field measurements. And then what we do have to compare these to are 2D, sort of hybrid 2D, 3D simulations of the magnetosphere of this class of neutron star that don't have high multiplicities of charge carriers in the magnetosphere. And in those simulations, we find that the predictions that we would make for the flux from the Goldberg-Julian model are quite close to the simulation results. So that does depend on the assumption that the magnetic fields are predominantly dipolar. And I believe for these neutron stars, measurement indicates that they are predominantly dipolar. But there are other neutron stars that there is evidence for a quadrupolar magnetic field. And if you wanted to do an analysis and make a valid prediction for what the flux would be, then you would need to include that quadrupolar component as well.
Yeah, like, you know. Well, my impression from these, like, you know, nicer measurements, for example, you know, was that, you know, these neutron stars can often have extremely complicated, you know, geometries for their magnetic field.
Right.
Okay. And I would think then that, you know, therefore that uncertainty would then translate into some, you know, corresponding uncertainty on this plot when you translate from the radio measurements to your bounds on the parameters.
Yeah. So I think that is true and fair. One reason that you are a little safer at these masses is we're looking at masses where the conversion radius is actually pretty far from the neutron star surface.
So you're dominated. You're saying then by
the dominated by the dipolar field. I think it's true that as you got closer to the conversion or closer to the neutron star surface, you would need to model in more detail other components of the magnetic field.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, great, thanks.
Yeah. So, this is, I guess, our point, which is that we think that these limits on the isolated neutron star from the isolated neutron stars rather are pretty robust. Whereas there's an important systematic uncertainty to be shown in these population surveys, but it's a scenario where the optimistic model is still totally compatible with the data. So we just like to wait and see before we throw that one out. Cool. And last, one of the important things for any likelihood search is you need to be able to detect something. So I showed you injection tests, but what does the distribution of actual significances in our data look like? So on the left, what I'm showing you is after all of the hard work we've done in cleaning the data and vetoing excesses that are inconsistent with an axion and so on, what do we actually get? So black is the expected distribution of test statistics, and the colored lines are the distribution of test statistics that we get from the eight or so different observations that we actually get. We just don't show all eight limits because not all of them are that interesting. And you'll notice that even on the left, there is something that peaks out to a TS of about 90, and we set a TS of 100 as our detection threshold. So you're gonna have to take my word on it that we set that TS of 100 before we actually looked at the data, but we did. So it's worth looking at what that excess or that potential excess actually looks like in the data. But I do wanna compare this to the survival functions on the right, where you can see before we did any hard work on cleaning the data, we had excesses everywhere. Anyway, as far as what that excess looks like, it looks something like this. So the first thing to look at is the blue and the green data. So the blue data is the on data at the galactic center. The green data is the off data, so taken about a degree away from the galactic center. And you can see that these agree pretty well, with the exception of this one place in the data at relative frequency zero because I'm centered on that excess, where the difference between the on and the off data, when you calibrate to an antenna temperature, gives you a huge spike in the antenna temperature. This is what looks like a TS of 90 excess. You can see that there are other things going on in the data, and it's sort of, it looks awfully suspicious the way that the on data and the off data are just barely misaligned. But we don't have a good reason to veto it right now. It's just something that we would have to follow up on in future searches. So it's there. I don't think it's an axion. It's almost certainly not an axion, but it's there. Okay, so what are we gonna do in the future? We have a lot of new ideas for how to keep looking with different surveys. So the first is that there's this sort of incredible project called the Breakthrough Listen Project, which is nominally for looking for extraterrestrial life. And they do extremely high resolution searches in radio in the C-band, so between 4 and 8 gigahertz, which lets you probe axion masses of about 10 to 40 or 20 to 40 microE, which is a very nice region to be looking. So yeah, they have all this archival data, and we're figuring out how to use it and incorporate it into a search for axions. We have gotten time on the Murchison Wide Field Array, which looks at much lower frequencies, around 300 megahertz. That data we can also analyze and look for low mass axions. And we very recently submitted a new proposal for Green Bank time to have 24 hours to cover the 4 to 10 gigahertz band. Excuse me. And projections for that search compared to what we have already are shown in this plot on the right. So what our idea here is that we look at one isolated neutron star, which is expected to give a pretty good signal. Those are the constraints that we plot in dashed blue. And then we also want to look at the galactic center. What we plan to do for the galactic center is to do one fixed pointing and then one mapped pointing. And these let us gain different sensitivities by compensating more or less for the finite beam width that varies as a function of frequency for a Green Bank. So those are the projected.
Josh, what is the ALP cogenesis line?
Ah, that is a model for ALP production that some of my colleagues at Michigan have put together. I just pulled the slide out of our proposal. But the point here is just to, I'm not well versed in the details of the ALP cogenesis model, but the point here is just that there are reasons to think that that might be a good place to look. This is more for convincing the astronomers that oversee the Green Bank Telescope than really illustrating a compelling physics target.
Okay.
Yeah, it. One of the difficulties that we have is for these observations, we submit proposals to open calls. And for astronomers who submit proposals, there's a very clear science outcome. And for us, when we can say that we're going to set a leading limit, but for astronomers who are not familiar with an axion, that doesn't sound that exciting. So we need to show that we could do something.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You're tricking the poor astronomers, my God. So you're tricking these poor astronomers. You know, this is terrible. As an astronomer, I feel very offended.
But yeah, there are also a number of other instruments that would be reasonable to look at, and there's a lot of work to be done to figure out an optimal search strategy. On the theory end, I told you quite a bit about some of the theory uncertainties that need to be addressed. So I think the full wish list would be: you want to have a detailed 3D simulation of the magnetosphere and the axion conversion. You want to consistently propagate outgoing photons, and you'd want to improve the neutron star population modeling. And there's some initial attempts towards doing this. You know, these hybrid 2D, 3D simulations of the magnetospheres. There was a ray tracing analysis of outgoing photons that didn't account for all of the effects that need to be, but we're getting there, but it's not there yet. Okay, so that's all I really wanted to say about the radio searches, and I see it's taking me quite a bit of time, but I want to briefly tell you about some X-ray searches that we've been doing as well. And those X-ray searches are going to be done at the same isolated neutron stars we were already thinking about for radio. So the story here is, let's get rid of this assumption that axions are the dark matter. Let's look for just a new degree of freedom. And these neutron stars, you expect them to have hot cores, something like 10 keV. But the reason you don't see order 10 keV photons coming off of them is because the neutron stars themselves are opaque to photons, and the surface temperature is only about 100 eV. So that means when you look at these neutron stars in X-ray, you only see a soft X-ray spectrum. But if you had an axion in your theory, you could have axions produced in the neutron star core by nucleon-nucleon scattering. The core is transparent to those axions, and they could make their way out before they then converted to photons in that neutron star magnetosphere. The axions turn out to get produced with roughly thermal energies, so about 10 keV. And then if you point your X-ray telescope at these neutron stars, you could see a hard X-ray signal. So what we're going to do is we're going to take archival data from the XMM Newton and Chandra telescopes and look for exactly that hard X-ray spectrum. One of the things that's important here is that we're looking with two different telescopes. XMM Newton has two instruments on it, PN and MOS, and Chandra just has one camera. But the point is, all three of these instruments have different systematics. And while you might not have believed anything that you saw with just one instrument, you believe it more if you see it in all three. And that's exactly the scenario that we find ourselves in. So this plot is distilling quite a bit of work. And what we do is we construct images that are from these X-ray observations. And this little red star is telling you actually where in this pixelated image the neutron star is. So we're looking at a particular neutron star, RxJ1856. And what I've plotted for you is the test statistic in each pixel associated with any potential excess in that pixel compared to the background expectations. Also, these blue circles are showing you locations of identified point sources that we mask out of these images. So if you look at the PN, MOS, and Chandra test statistic maps, you see appreciable evidence for an excess within this solid circle, which is our signal extraction region, compared to the expected background that's determined by looking at the count, number of X-ray counts in the annular region. So when you look at the data, we can look at energies basically between 0 and 10 or 8 keV with these two telescopes. And what you're seeing here is the soft flux coming from the surface emission. And then between 2 and 8 keV, you have some non-zero excess of hard X-rays that you wouldn't have expected to see coming off of RxJ1856. So to compare this to what you'd expect from actual like simulations of these neutron stars and the detectors where we account for neutron star atmospheric models and pile up in the detectors, you expect to see this dashed blue line for the soft emission. And then these blue data points are the expected hard flux coming from the atmosphere, the neutron star atmosphere, and the pileup. By comparison, if you had an actual high energy tail in the data, then you would have seen what's in red. So red we have in solid, the soft emission plus high energy tail. And the red data points show simulated spectra associated with that that expected spectrum. And then you compare that to what's in gray, which is the real data that we have analyzed in these images. And we see that gray is, you know, quite a bit more compatible with red than it is blue, which is to say that we think we have evidence for an excess at these neutron stars.
Josh, how many bits are we talking about here?
Say that again?
Like how many total like number of photons are we talking about here?
Yeah, okay, good. So for 1856, I'm gonna talk about it in the context of this plot. So on the right, I'm showing you the detection significance for an excess in each of the seven neutron stars that we look at. And we see an excess in 1856 and 0420. And that is expected basically because it scales with the observing time in that at 1856, within our signal and background regions, we're seeing like 3,000 photon counts in this 2 to 8 range. And in 0420, you're seeing about 1,000. And then by the time you get to all of the other neutron stars, it's order 10 or 100 if you're lucky. So basically, we're seeing this excess at the neutron stars where you would expect to have the best statistical precision. I should also say that when you do get into the large number of counts, you would worry that, about pileup. So that's one why we did pileup simulations, but also these are stacked observations, about 40 independent observations. So, you know, you're seeing order 10 counts per observation, and you don't expect pileup to be a major issue there. Cool. Some of my collaborators continued on in this work, and they interpreted this excess in terms of an axion, where you see some maybe 2 sigma evidence overall for an axion of mass less than about 10 to the minus 5 EV. By comparison, actually, the significance of the excess detection is almost 5 sigma. There's just more nuisance parameters that reduce your significance when you actually look at the fit to the axion model. Okay, but we're in a little bit of a scenario where we didn't see the forest for the trees because we were so focused on looking for excesses at neutron stars that we didn't until recently think about another way that you could have an X-ray excess. The story here is that in lots of stars, you can just be producing axions in their hot cores. So this is, again, what CAST is exactly looking for, axions that are produced in the hot core of the sun. But there are particularly good targets in superstar clusters where the stars tend to be very, very hot, or at least the superstar clusters host populations of stars that are very, very hot. So like all good things, we have a result from Raffelt that says that in these hot stars, you have an axion luminosity that's going to be scale something like 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 7, or excuse me, temperature to the 4, temperature to the 7. So what you want to do is look for stars that would be producing axions and find the hottest of them, point an X-ray telescope, and figure out some way that those axions produced would then give you X-rays. Here you can see just a few axion luminosity spectra for different spectral stellar classifications. And the way that we're going to convert these photons into, the way we're going to convert these axions into X-rays is through conversion in the galactic magnetic field. So the galactic magnetic field has sort of 2 components, one of which is a coherent part, and that's plotted on the left. And then there's a random component that is overall larger actually in magnitude. But we're actually not going to consider that random component, mostly because the random component isn't sufficiently statistically characterized for us to actually use it in an analysis. We're just going to restrict to the coherent part. And as these axions are produced from the hot stars, you can compute their conversion probability by computing this line of sight integral of basically the magnetic field that they propagate through. And there are uncertainties, but we try to make some conservative underestimates for them, and I can tell you more about that, but I kind of want to get to the punchline. We look at 3 different superstar clusters, 2 of which I'm looking at here, and we consider a few different magnetic field models. And for an axion of a coupling 10 to the minus 12 inverse GeV, you have a pretty appreciable conversion probability, something like 10 to the minus 4 rather, as these axions propagate from their production in these stellar cores onto Earth. And what we're going to do is we're going to look with NuSTAR, which is a really great instrument to do this search for, because the spectra that we're looking for are going to have support, pretty broad support over 0 to 100 keV. XMM and Chandra only let us look from 0 to 8, but NuSTAR is going to let us look at energies between 10 and 80 keV. So that's quite nice. We're covering a much larger range of the interesting part of the spectra. Okay, so what do we actually do? We do another image analysis. We look at the data. So based on the stellar positions and classifications, we can produce an expected signal map. So that's what's shown on the very left. The little black stars are the actual locations of the stars. And this is showing you the expected number, the expected flux in these pixelated images. We have a background map. What was convenient for us is actually there's a designated NuSTAR tool for producing these background maps. And then we have the actual data, which is the final plot on the right. So we do a template analysis of signal map plus background map on the data. And we come up with a residual spectrum for the signal model. And it looks like what's shown at the bottom. And you can compare that to the expected signal associated with an axion of coupling 4 times 10 to the minus 12 inverse GeV. No axion there. This is from looking at the quintuplet SSC. We do a similar analysis looking at a superstar cluster called Westmoreland 1. The only quirk here is that there's actually a magnetar that we have to mask out because it does source some low energy flux. We also mask out the 0 to 15 keV range due to the presence of ghost ray contamination in the image. But once we've done that, we have 138 kiloseconds of exposure, and we can set a pretty nice constraint on axions again, because in this residual spectrum, there's nothing. Okay, so the limits that we get at the end of the day look something like this. So I'm showing on the top the quintuplet limit, and in the bottom, the Westmoreland 1 limit. And red is then the limit that you get by joining the likelihoods of both superstar cluster analyses. So what is this getting you? This is beating CAST. It's slightly beating supernova bounds. And it's a little bit weaker than these X-ray observations that lead to limits from looking at the Perseus cluster. But for both the supernova bounds and the Perseus cluster bounds, there are systematics that you might be worried about. In particular, the assumptions that the group made in analyzing the Perseus data on the turbulent spectrum of the intergalactic magnetic field don't seem consistent with data. So the limit we're setting, although weaker, is a little bit safer since it's coming from the galactic magnetic field, which is quite a bit better studied than the intergalactic magnetic field. Okay, so where are we going in the future? We still have this outstanding excess in RxJ 1856, and we've submitted a proposal to observe it with NuSTAR, the same telescope that we used for these SSC limits. And this is exciting, again, because NuSTAR is going to cover quite a bit larger a fraction of the expected spectrum. If this is indeed coming from an axion, then XM, Newton, and Chandra were able to. So blue is showing you the region we analyzed already, and red is showing you the region we'll be able to analyze with NuSTAR data as compared to a few different model predictions for the photon spectrum, depending on the way you model the neutron star. And there's also some exciting directions to go in terms of thinking about new axion production mechanisms. So one thing that we're thinking about right now is just degenerate fermion production of axions in these neutron star cores. So asking, can the production from basically electron cyclotron radiation or muon cyclotron radiation give you an interesting spectra? Here I'm just showing you some generated spectra we've made. It seems like the answer is yes, and that we've done a very crude analysis and seen that sort of the limits and best fits that you get matching the muon spectrum to the excesses that we saw are roughly compatible with the data. There's also a potential neutron star cooling story in that we can model these isolated neutron stars and figure out what their temperatures are. And then we can try to understand how those temperatures would have evolved had there been an axion coupling that caused appreciable cooling. This is all very early stages, but I think it's a fun new way to keep carrying on this work. Anyway, I think I have reached my hour, and I have backup slides, and I can talk about more, but I'm happy to stop for questions now.
Okay, so I can ask a question, if you don't mind. So for your X-ray constraint, so I didn't catch, so for these measurements, was there like some sort of foreground signal that was being subtracted? Or instead, do you just find that there's like no X-ray photons over this part of the sky, over that part of the spectrum?
Right. So we didn't do any direct background subtraction. What we had is these, so it's this center map. And this map is the expected background based on the on sky position that you're looking at. So we then do this template analysis in each energy band. So we fit an amplitude of the signal template, and we fit an amplitude of the background template. And then what's shown in this this residual plot is basically the fitted signal amplitudes and uncertainties that mm-hmm. come out of that likelihood analysis. So we don't do any background subtraction. We tried to restrict ourselves to just this template-based analysis.
Like, but there are, though, X-ray photons that are being assigned to your background template rather than the signal template. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so how different, then, I guess, are these two templates from each other?
Oh, well, so good. So the way you compute the signal template's on the left, and you can see that it's pretty peaked at the center, whereas this background template is fairly homogeneous. The only differences that you're actually seeing in the from pixel to pixel really are coming from down binning effects when you stack the data. So,
okay. So the difference is just mainly in like the spatial
morphology. Exactly. Yeah. Morphology. And the way you do this is by you have a star with a known position and spectral classification. You generate its expected spectrum, you place it, and then the expected signal, and then you smear it by the telescope's point spread function.
Oh, okay. So the idea. Wait. Okay. Yeah. So then the idea for your signal template is that the photons just come like directly to us.
Yep.
From the stars, there's no like propagation effect or anything.
No. Just,
okay. I thought you were saying, you know, that these axions, you know, convert off of, you know, fields in our galaxy, turn into photons.
Yeah.
So that preserves like, the direction. Is that the idea?
Yeah. It preserves the direction. Yeah.
I see. Okay. Great. Thanks.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Josh again. Thanks, Josh, for your talk.